Hi, welcome back to another Writers After Dark. I'm Summer Brooks, and we're here because good stories start with the writers, since wherever there's a story, someone's either making it up or writing it down. And we are here to talk to a preeminent voice in thriller horror, Craig DeLuey. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm great, Summer. How are you?
Pretty good.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. First, full disclosure, I enjoyed Owl War a lot.
Oh, I'm glad you like that. Enjoyed sometimes isn't the right word. dread and terror. As we get nearer to maybe that type of scenario. Pretty scary times we live in.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later. But your new book, The Children of Red Peak, comes out on November 17th this week. And it's billed as horror. There's a very tense undercurrent of dread throughout this story, and especially David's character. He's just a mess, but you feel for him because he's been through a lot. And I will let you explain it because I don't know how to do it quite without going into spoiler territory, and I want to avoid that as much as possible.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. The Children of Red Peak, it's horror. It spans several genres. It's more literary than typical horror. It's more literary with horror elements than a straight up horror story, but the horror is certainly there. And one of my favorite types of horror is what Stephen King called the terror. He said you can do the straight-up horror story, you can do the gross-out, or you can do the terror. And the terror, where a lot of things are suggested, and you fill in with your imagination. It's that creepy feeling you get on the back of your neck if the lights suddenly go out on a haunted house. That's the kind of horror that I like, and this is the kind of horror this story goes for. So there is a very strong sense of dread until the horror elements are revealed in all their grisly glory. So it's a psychological and cosmic horror story. It's about a group of people who grew up in an apocalyptic cult. They survived its horrific last days. And now, years later, one of them commits suicide. The remaining survivors reunite to confront their past and the entity that appeared on the final night. So the story is told in two timelines, one where we see the kids growing up in the group and how everything goes wrong, and the other years later as adults where they're coping with trauma, such as you mentioned with David, they're all a mess, and ultimately trying to find closure on the tragedy as a way to heal. So again, the novel has a bit of a literary take. So thematically, it's about faith, family, and the fine line between belief and delusion, delusion that ultimately proves dangerous.
And you had mentioned enjoying the terror. I think I never called it terror, but that sort of psychological suspense thriller has also been my favorite slice of the horror pie. And just because what's happening to the characters is nibbling away at their sense of security. It's increasing, literally ramping up their fears, and those fears cause them to maybe do irrational things or maybe shut down completely. And reading people getting into that mess and unfolding their way out of it, I think is what's thrilling for me to read, because it could be a supernatural thing. It could be a horrific elder gods thing. It could be a madman living in the woods behind your house. You don't know. There's such a wide variety of sources for that sort of story. And I think that's what appeals to me the most. And in Children of Red Peak, you sort of hint at one direction, sort of a Heaven's Gate, Jim Jones type of situation, and then it diverges. That's all I will say.
Yes.
So what got you thinking about writing his story about this sort of cult?
Well, horror has a lot of tropes. For me as a writer, I'm always interested in either turning them on their head or examining their consequences. And The Children of Red Peak does both. So it looks at a cult from a more realistic point of view, where we see a religious group whose ways may seem alien to many of us, but it's really not all that bad. But then something changes. They hear the voice of God offering them a deal, and they transform into a horrific cult. A lot of the horror here is how quickly and how logically they transform. The deal they're offered and what they have to do to get it fits right into their belief system. And so it's one thing leads to the next on this very, very slippery slope from this happy community into something that we consider horrifying. The novel also looks at what it'd be like to survive being in a cult that destroys itself, and how even though they survive, they never really escape. And eventually they'll have to go back to Red Peak to find closure. As far as the themes, I was interested in exploring the idea of how belief is a common trait, but it can run amok. Delusion is something that's very positive for the human species. It's a survival trait. It allows us to get through life, get through the day, and get through a lot of dangerous situations. But if there's a good kind of delusion where it would be, say, belief in something we can't see, but we believe it's there, we call that faith, that it can be a positive thing. But at the end or other end of the spectrum, it can be a dangerous delusion that can lead to violence and self-harm. So a lot of the inspiration for the story came from a reading of the book of Genesis, where God tells Abraham to bring his son Isaac to a mountain and sacrifice him as a burnt offering. Abraham does exactly that, and at the last moment, God tells him to stop. I thought it'd be interesting to tell that story from Isaac's point of view. What would it like to be him in that story? And what would it be like to be him for the rest of his life?
Wow, I never thought of that. Yeah, because you...
And if you want to go real psychologically destructive, what if God didn't stop him? And so that is just a source of incredible... not just direct horror. This child's going to be stabbed by his father in a sacrifice to God, but that God might allow it, or really want him to go through with it. And that's such a psychologically destructive idea. I couldn't resist it for a story.
Oh wow, yeah, because you sit there and you think, was hearing the voice telling you to kill your son the delusion, or did the delusion clear up in time for you to not hear God's voice tell you to stop?
Exactly. And that again shows that the coin of belief, where on one side is faith, which can be a beautiful and inspire great things, and then on the other side you can have delusion, which can inspire dangerous and evil things. And so really there's you know, it's why religion gives us throughout human history some of humanity's greatest moral acts and moral achievements, but also some of its greatest evils.
Yeah, there's a fine line there, and I'm wondering. I've wondered for years, actually, whether that line has become so blurred that the only way to recover is to step back from it, far back from it for a while, because you've seen so many examples of people who have faith, who have belief in something, and then you get a guy who puts themselves in charge of those people, manipulating them in the most vile ways to do vile acts, commit murders, commit mass suicide, you know, kill the ability to have faith in the people who might survive that. And it's sometimes you wonder, it's like these horror stories are we becoming more and more afraid of everything? Are we believing in the wrong things? Are we just flailing? And sometimes you just sit back and go, I just want a beer.
I think that's our default setting as a species, actually.
Just give me a
but
beer.
When we have a little more energy, we do greet the world. And yeah, a lot of times it's with fear, and fear is the source of so many evils in the world. One of the things that was really fascinating for me writing this book was the research I did. I was less interested in specific cults like Jim Jones, the People Temple, or Heaven's Gate. I did do some research there to learn about specific rituals and the methods they used and how they committed suicide and violence. But I was far more interested in exploring the psychology of cults and belief and what, because we look at people in cults and we're like, you know, first of all, they look like a bunch of hypnotized, mesmerized, blind killers, right? When you see the Manson family and you see the crazy eyes and you're like, this is the they're like, they're a cult. It's a word that has taken on brand new shades of meaning because of what cults have done. But there are thousands of these groups out there and thousands of people belong to them, and they could be very small or they could be really big groups and get on our radar, or they could be any size group and get on our radar because they do something horrible. But many of them are just alternative religious groups. They just have this, they splinter off of a mainstream religion and they say, we have some belief system that may be a little different, but we believe it and we're going to live according to it. And are they a cult? Not necessarily. Really what a cult is in the level of harm. Are they doing harm to themselves? Are they doing harm to their community or each other? And so once I started to learn all of this, I became really fascinated with that, with the psychological aspect, how people get into these groups. Well, they might be a little broken, or they might be a little lost, or they might look at a chaotic world and they say, I want this to make sense to me. I am afraid and I want to feel safe. I want to be in a group that gives me security and gives me unconditional love. And I can follow some charismatic leader I really look up to, and that person tells me what to think and what to do. And oh wow, what a relief. And then that may be fine for them. Where it becomes a cult is in the level of harm. Does that charismatic leader ask them to do things that are harmful to them? Does that group exploit them? A lot of times a cult will love bomb new members and then proceed to break them down, sort of like military training, to make them entirely dependent on the group. So that answering the next question I had during my research, which was, why do people stay in once they see what it's like? I get it that they're lost. They want a belief system. They find they're love bombed when they get into the group. They fall in love. But just like a bad relationship, shouldn't you want to get out of that? And a lot of these people just can't. Even when they do end up leaving, it's for kind of like relatively petty reasons. It's not that they're being exploited and systematically harmed. It's more that they asked me to do this and that wasn't fair. And this so-and-so got privileges and I didn't, and that wasn't fair. I'm angry with the group. I don't really see what they're like. I'm just angry with something they did, and so I'm more apt to leave. And then even if they do leave, it's very hard to actually leave. Like, they can physically leave the group. They can be banished sometimes, which is actually a punishment. To us, it would be a blessing, right? But to them, it's a punishment. Or they leave willingly, but they return to being lost. They find the world waiting for them. It's sort of like getting out of prison. You're happy to be out of prison, but your old life's waiting for you with all its problems, and you have to find a different way to cope. So I was really interested in all of this and how a group that might start out as an alternative religious movement, like the group in Children of Red Peak, where they're simple Pentecostals. They believe that God is living in their lives, intercedes in every day, that you can pray to God and get God, hopefully will do what you want, and that if you're good, you will be rewarded, and that the evil will be, all the evil people will be destroyed, and in the second coming, and you will go to heaven, and you will live with God, and you will be in bliss while everything else burns. And so I said, okay, again, I said, just like with Isaac, I said, okay, well, what if that's real? Let's see what that would look like to these people who actually believe this is happening. You're a teenager, you're growing up, and you're told the world's going to be ending in the next few weeks. What would you do with your time? How would you feel about this? How would you feel about the people you left behind before you left to join the group? Your relatives who aren't in the group, are they going to burn? What does this feel like? And so I was really interested. And then what does it feel like when the voice of God commands your group to do something that you don't want to do and you think deep down is actually evil, but it has this weird logic. This is how you get what you want. This is how you get to heaven. You have to do these things you don't like that are against every fiber of your being as human instinct, the good part of human instinct. But this, you're on this slippery slope as a group. We have to do this to get that, and we have to do that to get that, and we have to do that to get heaven. And I was just fascinated by all of it, and I brought as much of that into the book as I could, both through the lens of children growing up in this group and seeing as children do, very accepting but innocent, you know, and then the lens of them as adults where they are bitter and they look on the past as something horrific that they have to cope with the rest of their lives with whatever coping mechanisms they have. That was a long answer to a simple question, but boy, once you open that can of worms with psychology, and you get to do what horror does best, which is hold up a fractured mirror to the human soul and get the reader to ask questions that are a little bit more like, would I have opened the door? No, would you have gone along with this voice of God telling you what to do? Would you, even if it offered you the best deal? Would you? And I just love that idea of the reader being directly involved psychically with the book, and that whatever the character choices are, they're also facing because they're invested, not just in the characters, but also the theme.
And there's so many levels and layers in that you can go down a rabbit hole inside of a rabbit hole inside of a rabbit hole with this, because there's, for me, like that whole psychology always perplexed me. I think that's the best word I can use, because you're the love bombing thing. That's one of the signs of, you know, somebody who's falling into a narcissistic abusive relationship. You get smothered with love. You fall in love, and then they start withholding the love to control you. I'm like, what's going on here? And you play
along with it because you're already halfway in.
You're halfway in or all the way in. And at some point, you know, a person might realize that they are in a situation, but they start blaming themselves. Like, well, I let this person do this to me. And the reason they stay is because they don't want to lose everything, or because they don't want to face the shame that they got hoodwinked, they got tricked, they got lured into a trap and caught in it. And you know, you have that moment where someone goes like, I'm smart, I know what people are like, how did I get caught in this? And the shame of it, the shame of not wanting to deal with that with their other friends, if they have any left, they don't want to deal with it, so they stay. I'm like, why would you do that? You know, it's the don't open the door and go into the basement. Are you kidding me? Moment in the movie.
Right. It's powerful, especially when the source of horror might be yourself and something good. I mean, this is not something that would seem strange to the majority of people. These people simply believe that the living spirit acts through us constantly, and God's coming, Jesus is coming back very imminently. And God intercedes in human affairs, and we're going to live this great Christian life. I mean, it's that doesn't sound terrible. It might to some people, but to many people, they'd be like, "Oh, if you want to live that way, that's great. You're trying to do good, right?" But then that could be flipped so easily to become evil through the logic inherent in the belief system is just something that's fascinating and psychologically, quite challenging, I think. It's one of the reasons I didn't make the group doesn't start out like this dastardly cult, like a stereotype. And not everything starts out like the Manson family, where we envision these people just be having this grisly evil, we just picture them a certain way, helter skelter and all that. A lot of these cults don't operate that way, or groups don't operate that way. And in this case, it doesn't really, it has some trappings of a cult. They love bomb, but so does any evangelical religion has some trappings of a cult. The difference is like love bombing, thought control, community, all belief, simple belief system, worldview, all of that we find in conventional religion. The difference is that there's some kind of novel belief and then the level, really the level of harm. That's what makes it a cult. And it's one of the reasons I made the leader of this community in the book he's very charismatic, but he's not a bad guy. And the question is open almost to the end, was he a narcissist who was acting out his own fantasy or not? He's a likable character, and you feel for him. When he's going to be doing the horrible stuff as the leader, he takes a lot of it on, he inflicts a lot of it on himself. He plays the role of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, saying, "Please take this cup from me. Just does it have to be this way?" But it does, so he goes along with it. And that, so I wanted to show this very strong evangelical community as something positive in the beginning before I destroyed it by introducing the horror element, and to show how challenging it's not all served on a plate. Here's your cult, they're evil, let's fight them. That's fun. But psychologically, I didn't really think very much. I wanted to go the other way and show a very realistic religious group that transforms into a cult. And even when they become evil, they think they're doing good. In fact, they're objectively morally good right to the end. And that's the open question that actually goes right to the heart of the novel and right to the end of the novel.
So, did any of the research you did influence how you were going to portray some of the acts or some of the behavior of the survivors?
Oh, absolutely. I studied in depth how people cope with trauma. And so we have these three main characters who we see them growing up in the group in the past, and then we see them as survivors of the cult in the present, where it happened 15 years ago, the horrific last night. And so we see, like, for example, with David, David is going through so much trauma as a kid. His parents are fighting. His mother takes him and his sister on this giant road trip. They end up in some weird group that's very alien to him, isolated from everything he's ever known. They're very low tech. He's just thrust into this new situation. So he does a lot of withdrawing, and which is a natural coping mechanism for a child. But as an adult, we see him take that to a whole new level. He's just hiding constantly from his own family, from his life, from his past, from everything. And it defines who he is. This coping mechanism has really become who he is. And he has to make a choice at the end who he really wants to be and take that leap of faith to accomplish that. And then we have Beth, who's sort of a negotiator in the past, trying to make everything work. And then we see her in the present. She's a psychologist, and she does that for a living now. And she does that with herself, keeping things so tightly controlled that she's scarcely living. She's just sort of structuring her way through her life. And then we have Deacon, who was loving and outgoing and loved to sing when he was a kid. He was exposed to poetry therapy and the therapy after they were rescued, and ended up turning that into a songwriting career where he wants to feel that pain. He doesn't want to avoid it. He wants to feel that pain. And so he sings about his feelings and his experience on stage as sort of a ritual self-crucifixion, so that he can relive. And to him, that's his way of coping and staying alive. And so you see the psychology there is, again, very interesting in how you see these children with certain predominant traits that then run amok as coping mechanisms as adults, and they have to confront themselves and their past to heal, to really heal and get through closure. And finding that closure will take them back to Red Peak, where it may not be as easy to escape a second time.
Now, like I said, I don't want to spoil this story because I'm not finished it yet, but it was very hard to put down a couple of nights ago. And
well, I'm glad you're enjoying it.
Yeah.
Thank you for reading it.
Yes, the appeal of having to face a monster that you thought was gone comes up a lot. You know, monster movies, monster stories, people recovering from childhood traumas, children who are still in the middle of not so good situations. Those stories fascinate me because you start to realize that more and more people have more in common with those situations than we like to think. And the definition of horror is sort of expanding. And that I think the shift away from the maniac who just slashes and gores people just for the blood of it.
Right.
To the monster who has that was in the Lord of the Rings movie. It's a servant of evil would feel fouler, but look fairer, you know, that sort of, you know, the evil in an angel's face or something like that.
Or is in you.
Yeah.
And even in your good intentions.
Yeah. Cause when you believe that what you are doing is good and you are willing to sacrifice someone else's happiness or security or life in order to make sure that the quote good that you are doing is achieved, is it really good?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Oh goodness. But yeah, this story is extremely compelling. The research that you have shown in exploring the psychology of different traumas is fascinating. And did you use any of the DSM manuals at all?
No, I'm not sure what that is exactly.
Oh, it's the encyclopedia of the clinical definitions of the various psychological.
Oh yeah, I don't know that I went that in depth. I looked at, you know, I probed my own understanding of trauma. I probed, and then I looked for the clinical view of it. Like, so I especially in Beth's case, because she's a psychologist who deals specifically with trauma, treats people for trauma. So I wanted her to have all the nomenclature right and what the latest thinking was. So I did a lot of research, but it was more magazine reading, you know, not as deep, because I, you know, you have to write a book.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, no,
I mean, that could be a pursuit on its own. So it was more research than a dedicated pursuit.
Yeah, I just wanted to find out, like, how much of the study of psychology did you do in order to ground her background, her approach during the story? So I guess I kind of answered my question.
Yeah, and I looked for the latest schools of thought and what was hot in terms of basic approaches. For example, at she goes to a conference and hears about a talk being given on virtual reality that, you could go into a virtual reality environment designed to replicate a traumatic experience so that you can confront it and it removes its power over you in doing so. And so I did a lot of that kind of research, and then of course the fundamentals of how do you treat trauma, what are the different approaches. And that was interesting on its own. There was a lot of good stuff there.
Cool. So what other reading do you do for fun and not for research?
Oh boy. Well, you know, I find that my career has reached a level where I'm constantly reading related to the writing because I'm doing so much writing. You know, years ago, my tastes were extremely eclectic, and I loved reading certain types of books, and I would learn something from every single one of them. And now when I'm writing something, I tend to read a lot of what I'm writing, fiction that's related to it. So I can see how other authors are approaching the same subject material, or I read nonfiction just to give me background, and I fill up, notebook after notebook. While I'm also dreaming the novel, when I'm in the shower or driving a car or about to go to sleep, I'm picturing scenes in my head and as a form of meditation. So I can realize the book in a really organic way. This follows that, and that follows that logically. So that's probably most of the reading I'm doing these days. For example, I write these little pulpy World War II series. I self-publish those, and they do extremely well. They're very popular. But lately I've been reading a lot of books about World War II aviation. And you only have so many hours in a day, so that's probably most of my reading. But for fun, I have picked up Fallen in Love with Bernard Cornwell. He's the author, wrote the Sharp series. He did the Saxon Chronicles, the Netflix show. The Last Kingdom's based on that. And now I read pretty much every Uhtred book the guy wrote. The last book in the series just came today in the mail. In fact, it's brand new. Very happy about that. And can't wait to dive into it. And then I'm reading his Warlord series, which is a really fantastic retelling of the King Arthur legend. I'm bored with the King Arthur legend because it's so overly familiar, but it's his approach is fresh and it's realistic and it's just fantastic storytelling. So I'm kind of on a Bernard Cornwell tear right now when I'm not reading World War II aviation and horror.
Is that the Sharp series? Is that what the TV series Sharp's Rifles was based on?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He has a whole bunch of books about a British officer in the Napoleonic Wars.
Nice. So
Sean Bean played Sharp in the series.
That's why I remembered it.
One of his few roles where he doesn't get killed
or left behind. So in your writing, you said you're also, working on the World War II series. How many different stories do you work on at the same time?
Oh, one at a time. I'm such a linear thinker. I'm terrible at, very much so. But I'm also Mr. Hyperfocus with that linear thinking. So that gives me the deep penetration into the process where I can just get right inside my head and basically a movie is rolling out and I'm writing, from that and power of imagination, building on a foundation of notes and then a pretty decent structural plot and character, plot outline and character arcs. And that's all driven with detail, this huge amount of fertile detail, which is all the research I've done that makes it really come to life and feel real. And so those elements that I research for a given story will be the character arc. So who is this person and what drives them? So I know exactly what they want in every scene. And then I have the basic plot structure, which is when does everything change and when does everything change and when does everything change? And then what is the end? And then I have all the great research and details that go into it, and to provide an utterly realistic world so that you can suspend your disbelief as much as possible as a reader, and invest in the character and feel what they feel and be an ordinary person thrust into an extraordinary situation.
So do you do you preload, front load all of your research and then go into the story, or do you do enough research to get started and then refer back when you need to while you're writing the story?
Yeah, it would be the latter there, the second thing you said. You can't foresee every bit of research you'll need usually. And plus, it's great to continue to do the research while you're writing, because it, again, hyper-focus is a wonderful state for writing, but it's exhausting. And so it requires utter dedication. And so when I'll write a novel in 6 weeks when I'm in the zone. So it's great to constantly reinforce that, which again keeps me from being as eclectic with my reading as I would have liked, I used to be, but it certainly gets the fiction coming out and at a quality level. And so I typically write a first draft, polish it up, and that's it. And through that process. And so it works for me. But yeah, I'll do more research as I'm writing to reinforce things and add new inspiration and detail as I go along. And then other times I do things on the fly. I'm like, oh, I need to look this up. And so I look that up. Mm-hmm. And I'll import that right into the book because it's needed at the time. You can't predict everything at the beginning, you know, but nobody's ever truly a plotter. There's always some, what they call, you know, pantsing, you know, writing by the seat of your pants. That mm-hmm. has to happen. And that's called the discovery. You know, you plot it out so that you know where you're going, your guideposts are, you know your route, but you don't know what you're going to see and where you're going to stop to eat along the way. And that's along that journey. And so that's, to use a metaphor, that's what it's like. You have this organic discovery process along this route you've plotted out for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I've heard some authors say that sometimes they're a little hesitant to go on a research run while they're in the groove writing the story, because they might get distracted by a rabbit hole and pull them out of the groove. So it I guess it varies from person to person, but you said you have a tendency to hyper-focus, so that probably helps.
Yeah, it works for me. That's all I can say. I mean, it's one of those things that I think there are general rules to writing that are probably universal, but aside from a few basic rules, everything is really how you want to do it and whatever works for you. The only time I'd say a writer is doing it wrong is if they are sticking with an approach that isn't working for them. They need to change it up, and they need to innovate and to explore different methods to find something that will work for them. And the funny thing is that can vary book to book. You know, some stories need this type of approach to getting it done. Like, I've written books that were extremely plot heavy, and so I had my four acts and the plot points, and I just wrote to the end. And other times I, you know, for example, with the Children of Red Peak, it was more driven by the character arcs. I had people start as X and I wanted them to end as Y. I gave them their ghost, which was the source of their trauma. And then I let them do their thing so that they could change by the end. Some of the characters may not change, in which case it's a negative or neutral character arc, and other characters do change in the right way, which makes it a positive character arc. All that was plotted out, and that really drove the story, because it's a character-driven story, far more than what happens, the plot in the story. But that's that book. Other books, like my World War II fiction, is usually I have the character grows, but they don't have a big flaw that needs to be, or misbelief that needs to be corrected. The world needs to be changed because of them, sort of like, you know, a Braveheart type of story, as opposed to, you know, Braveheart needs to change. You know, the, mm-hmm. England needs to change, not him, right? And so mm-hmm. he's the agent of that change, rather than, another story that's more literary where the character changes because they have a flaw or misbelief. And so, really, like I said, it really depends on the story, and stories demand different approaches.
Now, do you prefer writing in a series, or do you prefer the standalones like your last handful of books have been?
It depends what who I'm writing for and what I'm trying to do. Like when I write for big publishers like Hachette or Simon & Schuster, I like, you know, big standalone, big idea books. And so that's The Children of Red Peak is a perfect example of that. It thematically, it's very ambitious, and there, a lot of heart went into it, and it's a much bigger book. When I write my series, my business model and artistic model is more like the dime novel. Back in the 1860s, Bartleby's dime novels sold for a dime, and they were around 30 to 40,000 words, and they had a working class audience, and they were series where you had a likable protagonist who has they don't need the change. The world changes because of them. And they, you find themselves in one caper after another, book after book, right? Sure, you know, Sherlock Holmes will be a good example, although I wouldn't call him Doyle's, series, dime novels, but it's that kind of approach, Westerns, potboilers, that kind of thing, real pulpy and written for a working class audience. And so that's what when I write my series, that's what I tend to do, that approach, where I have a likable protagonist and they work their way up through the ranks in a branch during, you know, for example, World War II. One of my most successful series was sort of a Horatio Hornblower meets submarines in World War II in the Pacific. And so this young naval officer starts out dumb and inexperienced, and he works his way up, and he ends up the captain of his own submarine, taking it to the enemy, and it's you know, real American, and it's so it's got a little bit of rah-rah, which is in keeping with the time, but it's very realistic and shows the horrors of war, tons of action. Every story, the exact same. It's a formula. You start out with a little bit of action. Then you have a man in a hole plot model where you have a character who starts out fine, ends up in trouble, and gets out of it. And those stories, and then I write them as 40,000 word episodes. I publish them in a series of five or six books. They sell like crazy, and people love them. This simple story, well told. They just love it. They don't want to think too hard. They don't want a big theme. They don't want crazy, anything ambitious. They just want a great story, well told, for their dime, which today is $2.99, which is where I price ebooks and my episodes, and where most Kindle books are priced at these days. A lot of Kindle people don't understand, but they do. Don't know this, but you know, when you account for inflation from the 1860s, they're writing dime novels today. And I'm happy to do it. I love doing that. They're fun, you know. They don't, and I can really dive into the research, like on how a submarine works, right? And what were all the procedures, and what was it like to live in one of these things and fight in one of these things, and how scary was it when the destroyer was coming overhead and looking for you on, and you could hear the ping of the rate of the sonar and the boom of the depth charges in the deep, knowing that one of them could flatten you and you would just, that's it. So there's just so much fun. But, you know, another part of my brain's like, yeah, but I love it. I love theme. And I want to write something really ambitious and try and connect with someone's soul, not just, you know, tickle their gut. And so I enjoy writing both kinds of fiction.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, tell our listeners where they can find you and your various flavors of fiction so they can check out more than just Children of Red Peak.
Sure. All my stuff's, you can learn more about it at my first name and last name.com, craigdelouie.com. And the last name is D-I-Louie, L-O-U-I-E. And at that website, you'll get synopses of all the books. You'll see all highlights of all the reviews the books have gotten. And I also have a blog where I write about just things I like in genre and elsewhere. A series I called on HBO, For example, I just watched The Plot Against America and reviewed it. I quite liked it. And then books I'm reading and and movies I've seen, anything like that ends up on the blog. And so people might, if they don't like my stuff, they might find something else they do like. There's lots there to explore. And as far as The Children of Red Peak, they can find that book in pretty much every bookstore. It's published by Hachette, one of the world's biggest and greatest book publishers. And so it'll be available everywhere, online and in physical bookstores and paperback and ebook. And then Dreamscape just acquired the audio rights, so the audiobook will be available soon as well. And if anybody wants to check out my pulpy World War II series, they can find those on Amazon. They're exclusively for Kindle. They're also available in paperback and terrific omnibus audiobooks, including one by the great R.C. Bray.
Wow. Well, that we'll have links to all of those so people can find your different stories. Craig, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It was a great conversation. Thanks very much.
Hey there, Mer Lafferty, co-editor of Escape Pod here, and I just wanted to let you know, if you are listening to this podcast right now, then you probably would enjoy our very first print anthology. Escape Pod, our 15th anniversary print anthology, will feature a mix of stories, some of which have been on the site, some are reprints that may be new to you, and some are brand new stories from people like T. Kingfisher, Maurice Broaddus, Greg Van Eekout, and our own Tina Connolly. I also contributed a story featuring the universe from my book, Six Wakes. So if you are in the UK, you can get your copy October 20th, and if you're in the US, you can get your copy on November 17th. But check it out. We're pretty proud of what we've done with this, just like we're pretty proud with what we've done with this entire podcast for the past 15 years.
And yeah, the book, The Children of Red Peak, is a compelling, difficult, yet thrilling read. And no, I'm not going to spoil it. You need to check it out for yourself. I'm curious how they would do the audiobook just because of the split in the timelines and the 15-year age difference between the characters from the first timeline to the present timeline, so I may see if I can get a sneak peek of that later on. But if you have any questions or comments about this book, this interview, or any others, please feel free to call. The number is 602-635-6976, or you can shoot me an email, summer@writersafterdark.com. You can listen to Writers After Dark through Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Player FM. And if you're listening on Apple or Stitcher, please leave us a review. Reviews let people know that you are interested in the show and maybe they should check it out for themselves. You can follow us on Twitter at Write After Dark. That's W-R-I-T-E After Dark. And you can check out the curated list of creator and creatives interviews over on the YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/sliceofsci-fi. And of course, there is the website, writersafterdark.com, where you can listen to other interviews, check out various reviews done for books, audiobooks, novellas and novels, and graphic novels, weigh in on them if you have read them yourself, and get the conversation started. That's what we geeks do. We talk about books, we talk about movies, we talk about TV shows, we talk about comic books. A lot of us talk about games. I'm not a gamer anymore, but I would love to hear somebody talk about the older Assassin's Creed games. Just because. Anyway, tangent. I'd thank everyone who is currently supporting this show and all the others in the Slice of Sci-Fi universe. Your donations, your pledges do help keep things around here online and active, available for everyone to enjoy. So thank you all very, very much for that. If you want to add your support, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. And people who are patrons are eligible for perks. Every month I pick an email out of the hat, so to speak, and that person can choose a DVD, a Blu-ray, a 4K disc, a book, either a finished book or an advanced copy. And that is my gift to you for your support. And if you would like to contribute but don't feel like dealing with a monthly pledge, the link to use is paypal.me/scifisummer. The theme music here is by Sibon Quest featuring Shay Dawn, and you can find other compositions of theirs through links on the website. But that'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time, and remember, keep looking for your own stories.